This evening on The Space Show, we answer this question.
What the hell was that?
And also this question.
What the hell was that?
Two questions uttered 50 years ago last Friday morning.
Hi, I'm Pete Conrad, commander of Apollo 12.
I'm Dick Gordon, command module pilot on Apollo 12.
I'm Alan Bean, Apollo 12 lunar module pilot.
To introduce the theme of our program, here is John Wesley Caves with Rocket to the Moon.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
In a rocket headed for the moon, in a rocket headed for the moon. Well, one day, baby, we're gonna be in a rocket headed for the moon. Regardless whether you believe it or not, we're making me go real soon. We'll walk right in, buckle down our feet, put our earphones on to hear the rock and roll beat. One day, baby, we're gonna be in a rocket headed for the moon. In a rock, rock, rocket to the moon. In a rock, 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 rocket to the moon. One day, baby, we're gonna be in a rocket headed for the moon. We can take off, the straps are held and be bound tight. We'll dance all over that rocket ship, live a honeymoon upright. We'll rock and bop in broad daylight, it'll be so different for there is no night. One day, baby, we're gonna be in a rocket headed for the moon. In a rock, rock, rocket to the moon. In a rock, 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 rocket to the moon. One day, baby, we're gonna be in a rocket headed for the moon. In a rocket headed for the moon.
Welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I am Andrew Rennie, and on the console in Mission Control, we have Jay. Yes, 50 years ago, three astronauts were at the moon. Two of them were on the moon, and the other was orbiting it at 100 kilometres above the surface. But they very nearly didn't make it there. On this evening's The Space Show, we tell that dramatic story. We are now going to keep up our moon theme with Rockin' on the Moon by Ronnie Sando. So, Rocking on the Moon, one of the things that the Apollo astronauts would have heard as they were growing up and preparing for their mission.
Monkey, monkey, you're a real good.
Southern FM. The sounds of the Bayside.
50 years ago, at this very moment, three astronauts were at the moon. They were the crew of Apollo 12. We have this report that they recorded before they set off on their lunar adventure, and they described what they planned to do.
Hi, I'm Pete Conrad, commander of Apollo 12.
I'm Dick Gordon, command module pilot on Apollo 12.
I'm Alan Bean, Apollo 12 lunar module pilot.
And this is Willard Scott reporting from the Manned Spacecraft Center, Houston, Texas. In a moment, details of the next moon landing mission through the words of the men who will fly it. NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, presents a special report, Flight to the Ocean of Storms, the mission of Apollo 12. The crew consists of three U.S. Navy commanders. Their vessels are appropriately named, the Yankee Clipper for the three-man command module and the Intrepid for the four-legged lunar module. The assignment, land on the moon. Charles Pete Conrad, 39-year-old native of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, you've flown in space twice before, aboard Gemini 5 and Gemini 11. Now, Apollo 12, the country's second manned moon landing. How do you feel about this?
Well, of course, I'm looking forward to it very much. This is what we've all been working for the last 7 years, really. The Gemini flights were preludes to this, and so I'm looking forward to it with not so much anticipation from the fact that it's exciting, but it's sort of the culmination of 7 years' worth of work.
Well, now, could you tell us a little bit about your career before you joined NASA? Did you start flying right after graduating from Princeton?
Right. I went right straight from graduation to flight training in the Navy and spent almost 4 years in a fighter squadron in Jacksonville, Florida. Then I went to the Navy's test pilot school in 1958. It's getting a while back. I have to scratch over the numbers. And spent a year in armament test there and went back to the school as a performance instructor and to teach other Navy pilots how to be test pilots. And from there I went to the West Coast and was in one of the first Phantom squadrons on the West Coast. And at that time I was accepted in NASA as an astronaut in September of 1962, and I've been here ever since.
Well, now, your flight plan to and from the moon, Pete, is very similar to last July's Apollo 11 mission. The landing sequence for you and Alan Bean will be just as difficult, if not more so. Your schedule currently offers the possibility of touching down near the Surveyor 3 spacecraft, which landed in the Ocean of Storms 2.5 years ago. If you succeed in landing close to Surveyor, I understand that during your second 3-hour period of service activity, you and Al might very well examine the Surveyor and its surroundings, picking up carefully documented rock samples on the way. Is that right?
Well, there are two possibilities, and the first one is that we do land close enough that it's really right at hand. When I say right at hand, within 300 or 400 feet. Then there's the possibility that for some reason or another, it is close enough for us to walk to, but it's not readily at hand. It's, say, 2,000, 2,500 feet. In the latter case, we would plan our geology traverse so that at some point in that traverse we would wind up at the Surveyor. And in other words, that's the most efficient way to utilize the time and just walking to it would be to do this documented sample en route to the Surveyor and back from it. And of course the other is we can run a traverse anywhere we want to and come back to the spacecraft, leave the rocks, and then just wander over to the Surveyor, which says we landed very, very close to it. In either event, when we get there, I have a set of cutters that will be...
Now, this is a hand tool, right?
Yes, it's a large set of bolt cutters is what it amounts to. And we have a bag. And aside from the photographic information that we should bring back about the Surveyor, and Al is going to take the photographs, the other thing which would be interesting, and we have four items which we're going to try and retrieve off the Surveyor with the bolt cutters. And that is, we don't need the bolt cutters for the glass, but there's some thermal glass that was mounted on it as a thermal shield. And this glass has been sitting out for 31 months exposed to micrometeorites, and we can bring the glass back for him to examine. And the other thing that would be interesting would be a polished aluminum tube, which is relatively easy to cut off, which also has been exposed both to micrometeorites and the solar wind. And then there is the TV camera that is mounted on there that has some cabling to it. Now, they would like us to cut a sample of the cable off. And the last thing is the TV camera, which is a multitude of different kinds of parts. By bringing back that TV camera for analysis, the engineers would get a very good handle on the effects of long-duration exposure to the space environment on materials, and would crank this into, obviously, later designs of both unmanned and manned satellites that you want to stay up and operate for a long time. So these are the bonus benefits that we'd get by making a spot landing next to the Surveyor.
We'll certainly be wishing you good luck on that landing, Pete Conrad.
Thank you.
Dick Gordon, 40 years old, born in Seattle, Washington. You've flown in space before with Pete Conrad, the rendezvous and docking and spacewalking mission of Gemini 11. When did you come into the astronaut program?
I was selected in late 63 and moved to Houston, arrived on New Year's Day in 1964.
Well, now as command module pilot for Apollo 12, Dick, you'll continue to circle the moon while Pete and Alan Bean descend to explore the ocean of storms. Your job as a lunar orbit watchdog of sorts is sort of similar to that of Mike Collins during Apollo 11. Could you sort of summarize your responsibilities for us now?
Well, I think by and large, it's fairly simple to describe those. It's basically the same as Mike's was. We jokingly, I guess maybe not jokingly, call ourselves the bus drivers. Pete and Al get in, I say leave the driving to me, and away we go. It is a challenge in its own right. I am basically responsible, or have that responsibility, after the launch and after the insertion in the translunar coast, being cognizant of the command module itself. Obviously, they're there and they're with me and they know a great deal about it. But I think Pete has genuinely left that responsibility with me, and he's counted on me to fulfill that task of making sure that the command module does its job. In other words, it gets them to lunar orbit. It fulfills its requirement for getting the lunar module ready. It stands by in all cases to rescue the LEM in the event that that has to be done. And of course, we all hope that it doesn't. That's a formidable task in itself. Being responsible for the rendezvous itself after their lunar surface activities are completed. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, coming back home, the navigation that must be done, and the entry itself. These are the things that I'm responsible for.
Well, now, Dick, after the surface activities completed and Pete and Al are safely back inside your command ship, the flight plan calls for the three of you to spend an extra day in lunar orbit to photograph future Apollo landing sites. Do you consider this a major part of the Apollo 12 mission?
It certainly is, and I think it's a very vital aspect of this flight. It's an added feature, you might say, of our flight, and if you really look at it, it's exactly what Apollo 8 did on their flight. We've tacked that on as an addition to ours. But that's an indication, I think, only of the amount of activity we'll be doing. And it is all basically surveying and basically photography for future Apollo flights. I think to make the future of Apollo interesting, captivating, and certainly scientifically valuable, we must go to the areas on the lunar surface that are the most interesting significantly as far as geology is concerned. Plus the fact that the techniques of spot landing with the LEM have to be developed. We haven't done it yet. We're going to attempt it on this one. But the more we try and the more we do this, I think the more we'll learn so that someday we can, in fact, park that LEM on a plateau that's right alongside of a mountain. Now, this is the type of thing we're interested in.
Well, thank you very much, Dick Gordon, and good luck to you during the flight.
Thank you.
Alan Bean, 37-year-old native of Wheeler, Texas, and a member of the astronaut team for going on 7 years now. How do you feel about your first space flight to the surface of the moon, no less?
Pretty happy, and I think it's been worth the wait.
Really worth the wait?
You said it.
Now, when did you come into the astronaut program, Al?
I've been in since, I think it's February of 1963, and it's been a constant train since then, and it's been most interesting experience anyone could imagine.
Al, you and Pete Conrad are scheduled to spend two separate three-hour periods out on the lunar surface. During the first EVA, plans call for deployment of five scientific experiments onto the surface. A seismometer to detect moonquakes and other instruments to measure the lunar environment. This package of experiments is nicknamed ALSEP. Could you tell us maybe a little bit about this?
Okay, as you know, the ALSEP, Apollo Lunar Surface Experiment Package, is a combination of four or five. I use that word because one of them is a smaller and attached to another experiment that we're going to leave on the moon for forever. But it has a guaranteed lifetime of about a year. So it'll be sending back good scientific information for a year. We expect that it will operate then for another year just as well, even though it doesn't have to. And then after that, we probably won't be using it. But our job then is to put this package out on the surface where it will be best located to gain the information that it needs, that it is able to gather, and in a position where it won't be disturbed when we actually ascend from the lunar surface.
Now, you'll be deploying these experiments some distance from the spacecraft, isn't that right?
We will. Originally, we were going to take it out 200 to 300 feet. But as a result of Apollo 11 and some of the evaluations that have been done since then, we've decided that we probably ought to take it out, or the scientists have, and engineers that think about these things, decided that we ought to take it out about 1,000 feet. That's a pretty fur piece when you're in a spacesuit. So I think we'll try to get it out there, and it depends on the terrain. If it's got a lot of hills and dales and we got other things, we might not get it out quite that far, but we're shooting for that neighborhood anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, Pete Conrad has already explained that during your second period of service activity, you hope to make it over to the Surveyor 3 landing site. During both of your extravehicular periods, you'll also be concentrating on other things, gathering samples of lunar material, for example. Could you elaborate on this?
As you well know, our first period outside is going to be devoted largely to ALSEP, actually putting out the experiments package. Then with what time we've got available left, which is, let's say, half an hour, three quarters of an hour, it's hard to tell right now, we're going to do what we call a documented sample. And what we're going to do here is look around for as many different kinds of lunar rocks and lunar geological features we can see. We're going to take pictures of them and get as many different kinds of rocks as we can. We're going to load these rocks in the rock boxes and take them in with us in the first EVA. Mm-hmm. Now, the second time we get out, our main objective is to do a very good documented sample. And by documented sample, I mean we want to take a look at, once again, as many different kinds of lunar rocks as we can see and many different kinds of unusual lunar geographical features as we can spot. But we want to document them very accurately. For example, if we are going to collect a rock, Pete and I have a sort of skit, or rock dance, as I call it, that we go through. We move over to the rock. Pete steps cross onto it by about 4 feet, and before he steps to this position, he puts down a gnomon. This gnomon is sort of like a little sundial where we can cast a shadow near the rock, and you can tell the orientation of the rock relative to north or east or anywhere else. And you can also tell the tilt of it, and it also allows you to do some color matching because there's colors on this gnomon. He puts this down near the rock, and then he steps cross sun. I move in then to a down sun position, take a picture. He takes a stereo pair cross sun, and then starts to pick up the rocks with his tongs. I then get a sample bag, put the rock in the bag, maybe a quick discussion about any unusual features.
A discussion that I understand will take place with scientists here on the ground.
That's right. This is going to be one of the differences between our particular exploration and 11's. And also, I think we'll see it on all the following missions. As the lunar surface operation gets more complex, you're going to have to use the man on the surface to make on-the-spot observations and collections. But he isn't always going to have a lot of spare time to sit around and pontificate about just exactly what he's been seeing. So they're going to have a lot of scientists on Earth in the Mission Control Center that are thinking, listening to what you're saying, thinking about what you're saying. They'll be reflecting, and they'll come back and give us some advice. And so this is going to be a real team operation between the scientists on Earth and ourselves on the lunar surface.
Well, Alan Bean will be watching and listening here at home, and good luck to you during the flight.
Thank you.
Astronaut Alan Bean, together with Pete Conrad and Richard Gordon. Comments from Houston, Texas, about their upcoming Apollo 12 moon landing mission. NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, has presented a special report, Flight to the Ocean of Storms, the mission of Apollo 12. This is Willard Scott speaking.
We're gonna rock to the crazy tune. rocking on the moon all night. I hope everything is alright, 'cause we'll be rocking on the moon. I hope we're rocking on the moon. I hope we're rocking on the moon all night. I'm gonna grab me a spaceship, baby. We're gonna make it to the sea. We're heading straight for the moon, and there's no stopping in between. 'Cause we'll be rocking on the moon, I hope we're rocking on the moon, I hope we're rocking on the moon all night. Cause we'll be rocking on the moon, I hope we're rocking on the moon, oh baby, rocking on the moon all night. Can't deny that I love you with the love that's really true. I'm gonna make you my moon girl, I'll follow you with the craziest curve. 'Cause we'll be rocking on the moon, I hope we're rocking on the moon, oh baby, rocking on the moon all night. Rocking on the moon, I hope we're rocking on the moon, I hope we're rocking on the moon all night. Rocking on the moon, oh baby.
From Sandringham to South Yarra, you're listening to Southern FM.
Let's go back to those two questions we posed at the beginning of this evening's The Space Show. First this, which we will play four times.
The hell was that? The hell was that? The hell was that? The hell was that?
This was Command Module Pilot Dick Gordon's exclamatory question as Apollo 12 was struck by lightning seconds after liftoff as the 111-metre-tall Saturn V rocket propelled them through a thundercloud. That caused all sorts of problems aboard the command module. Essentially, the Yankee Clipper lost power from the fuel cells and only reserve batteries kept some of the spacecraft systems alive. Fortunately, the two lightning strikes did not affect the Saturn V rocket, which continued thrusting to lift them clear of the thundercloud and on towards orbit. Fortunately, back in mission control, John Aron had seen a similar power loss during training and made the recommendation that the astronauts switch the power system to SCE.
So, Houston, try SCE to auxiliary, over.
Now, when Commander Pete Conrad heard this, he said,
"What the hell's that? What the hell's that? What the hell's that? What the hell's that?"
Which we've played four times, so you can hear it properly. Fortunately, Alan Bean knew what it was and switched SCE, the signal conditioning equipment. The power came back on just as the Saturn V was about to jettison its fuel-depleted first stage and ignite the second stage. Listen now to how the launch of Apollo 12 went, as recorded by the cockpit tape recorder and unheard by the worldwide radio audience.
Pitch and a roll program, and this baby is really going.
Man, is it?
20 seconds. That's a lovely liftoff. That's not bad at all.
Everything's looking great. Sky's getting lighter.
Okay.
30 seconds.
Looks good.
Roll start, please.
Move.
100 feet.
The hell was that?
I lost a whole bunch of stuff. I don't
know. Buses.
Mark 1 Bravo.
Roger. We had a whole bunch of buses drop off. There's nothing.
It's nothing. I think it's.
What we got?
I can't see. There's nothing wrong.
AC bus, one light, all the fuel cells.
I just lost the platform.
All I got is GDC.
Yeah.
Okay, we just lost the platform, gang. I don't know what happened here. We had everything in the world drop out.
I can't. There's nothing I can tell is wrong, Pete.
I got three fuel cell lights, an AC bus light, a fuel cell disconnect, AC bus overload, one and two, main bus A and B out.
I got AC.
You got AC?
Yeah.
Maybe just the indicator. What do you got in the main bus?
Main bus is the both indicating 24 volts.
Huh? four posts. This is low. We got a short on it at some time. So I can't lose a post.
12 Houston, try FCE to auxiliary, over.
Try FCE to auxiliary. What the hell is that?
Still something. FCE to auxiliary.
Try the buses. Get the buses back in the line. They look, everything looks good. FCE to aux. The GDC is good. Stand by for the, I've lost the event timer.
One walking. Charlie.
One Charlie. 2 minutes, EDS auto is off. Yeah. EDS auto.
12 Houston, go for staging.
Roger, go for staging. We had some really big blitz tanks. One of the buses for you, though. Stand by. Center engine.
Okay. 12 Houston, try to reset your fuel cells now.
So reset the fuel cells. Wait for staging. Wait for staging. Yeah. Hang on. Hang on. 25, 27, 32. Got a clock running over there? Yeah. Hang on. 41. Come on, there it is. That's it. That's it. That's it. Staging. Hang on. Okay. GDC's good. Got a good attitude, gang.
Can we copy, Pete? You're looking good.
Temperature's okay. We're okay. Now we'll straighten out our problems here. I don't know what happened.
And it took them a little while to figure out what had happened. They were struck by lightning twice during that ascent. They changed the rules for launch after that. No way. If there's any lightning nearby, launch is off. Okay. Well, we're now going to go to a documentary which was made for radio in 1970. This documentary chronicles the Apollo 12 mission. And it begins by describing events that were in the minds of Americans during 1969. Now, the events that we've just played were off the cockpit flight recorder. What you'll hear now is what was heard by the public during this incident. Part one of our Apollo 12 documentary.
Just a few months later, after the ticker tape parades, publicity junkets, and interviews had subsided, Apollo fever was dying down. It was November 1969, and people had other things on their minds than another moon flight. So, a few months later, as Apollo 12 stood poised on Pad 39, most of America went about its affairs, unconcerned with the next moon launch. Letters were mailed with 6-cent stamps, politicians worried over the $184 billion federal budget, households worried about their $8,400 average earnings, unemployment hovered at about 3%, Vietnam dragged on, the FCC banned cigarette advertising on TV, and somewhere in the dark bowels of a few select American universities, the Advanced Research Projects Agency threw a switch, and wires hummed with activity, signaling the beginning of an experiment to be known years later as the Internet. All this was of little concern to the three men sitting atop the fueled Saturn V in Florida. It was November 14th, 1969, and all that Pete Conrad, Dick Gordon, and Alan Bean were thinking about was their impending flight into the cosmos. It was 11 a.m. at the Cape, and the weather was marginal for a launch. Dark clouds glowered over the launch area, and lightning was visible on the horizon. But NASA was already tense. President Nixon had decided to attend, and since he had already cut their funding, a good show was in order. NASA would provide that show at any cost.
We have guidance internal. 10, 9, 8, ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engines running, commit liftoff. We have liftoff, 11:22 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
When the clock read 22 minutes past the hour, flames licked the trench below Pad 39, and the Saturn leapt skyward. But before it had cleared the tower, there was a crash heard within the capsule.
Mark 1 Bravo. Roger.
Pete Conrad, the steely-eyed commander, gripped the abort handle. Even as he scanned the command module console for some kind of answer, all the indicators went dark. The general alarm sounded in his headset. The world went upside down.
Okay, we just lost the platform, gang. I don't know what happened here. We had everything in the world drop out.
Roger.
In mission control, the engineers saw nothing but digital mush on their screens. Nothing made sense. The downlink from the Saturn V was simply gibberish. There were calls to abort the flight.
I got three fuel cell lights, an HD bus light, a fuel cell disconnect, HD bus overload, one and two, main bus A and B out.
In the driver's seat on the ground, Gene Kranz, Apollo flight director, took a hard look at the data. He and Conrad arrived at the same conclusion. The rocket was still flying, all five engines burning. Why not continue? But there was one engineer in particular sitting in front of the electrical systems console named John Aaron. He saw the hash on his screens, and it reminded him of something that had occurred years earlier in an engineering test flight. He radioed to Kranz that they should reset the breakers, as it appeared that lightning might have caused the problem. Alan Bean quickly complied.
Apollo 12 Houston, try FCE to auxiliary, over.
NCE to auxiliary.
FCE to auxiliary. Copy, Pete, you're looking good.
Good staging and good thrust on the second stage.
Hey, now, there are problems here. I don't know what happened. I'm not sure we can get hit by lightning. I think we need to do a little more all-weather testing.
Amen.
With their first glitch behind them, Conrad became his more traditional self. The wisecracking, gee-whiz country boy.
Apollo 12 Houston, you're right smack dab on the trajectory. Your IU's doing a beautiful job.
Okay, we're all chuckling up here over the lights. We all said there were so many on we couldn't read them.
The entire crew of the ship was from the Navy. They were as light and jovial as Apollo 11's crew had been shy and stoic. They had fun watching the S-4B stage vent fuel after separation.
All that red stuff out
there.
That's
just what I was wondering. It's real pink out there.
Yeah, let me look and see.
Houston 12, what's going on with the booster?
All pink out there.
Yeah, something just, this looks like it's
blowing. Looks like you're getting a fuel vent.
Huh?
It's a normal fuel vent.
Hey, that's pretty spectacular.
Oh, no, I'll tell you what it is. The sun is on the my right side, and it's shining around the booster, and it's shining through the fuel vent, and it's made a rainbow. It's really spectacular.
Look at it.
Yeah,
I see the apex of where it all comes together out
yep,
there.
Sure can.
Look at that. What happened there? The vent must have shut off or something.
Still a little bit up this way.
Well, there's all kinds of things going
look
on
look at all
back
those
there.
Loose objects floating along with us down there.
See those jobs?
I said with us.
Now, Bina, there's a disaster waiting for us if we don't have those circuit breakers in over there on the land.
They're in. I've checked them five times.
All right. Let's get back to business.
Tunnel vent lights off.
Okay.
You want to go off box?
Yep.
Houston, we're going to leave you on off of box for a while. We'll be back with you a little later.
Okay, Dick.
And we'll hear more of that documentary on next week's The Space Show. Now, one error they made there, the flight director on duty was not Gene Kranz. For the Apollo 12 launch, the flight director was Jerry Griffin, who was here in Melbourne last year. Now, just reminding you that the launch was on November the 15th at 2:22 a.m. Australian Eastern Time. That was basically Friday last week. And they landed on the moon, and their splashdown occurred on November the 25th at 6:56 a.m. Australian Eastern Time. More about Apollo 12 next week, but now we've got some music.
Attention, Earthlings! The Neanderthals are prepared! To twist to the moon! 5, 4, 3...